Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about New Scientist, 17th of November 2018. Just reading it through. This will be several episodes as I get through and going through the different articles. Some very interesting articles here. And our first editorial by Emily Wilson. This is in episode one. Normally it's a two-part editorial, but Emily has taken a full two-thirds of a page to write on this one. So there's a picture taking up and some notes about contact us and various things here. The title is "Time to Talk Designer Babies." Should we screen embryos for traits like intelligence? No. Okay, that's done. And let's see, she's got something to say. It's hard to think of an area of science more controversial than genetics of intelligence. Now it's about to get exponentially more contentious. Okay, I just have to stop there because I like exponential functions and, yep. Okay, for a long time, DNA testing couldn't tell us anything useful about someone's IQ other than the traits afflicted by multiple genes such as diabetes or cancer risk. But new polygenetic techniques, whatever that means, for analysing many genetic regions at once have begun to make this possible. This week, we report on the first company offering fertility clinics a test for screening IVF embryos for disease risk and low intelligence. With this news, it's unlikely to be long before some clinic somewhere starts using a similar approach to offer prospective parents the ability to pick out embryos that look most genetically promising for high IQ. As if this isn't controversial enough, it may only be the beginning. As our understanding of traits governed by multiple genes grow, it may be also become possible to screen for embryos that are more or less likely to have a range of other features, be it sexuality, autism, susceptibility to depression. We already live in a world where wealthy individuals are willing to cross the border to pay procedures at the sharpest edge of fertility research. The first baby created using a particular three-parent technique was born 2 years ago to a Jordanian parents helped by the US scientists working from Mexico, for example. While many prospective parents won't want to genetically fine-tune their children this way, the idea of near-designer babies will undoubtedly appeal to some. The desire to maximise future child's intelligence, mental health and physical attractiveness would be enough to prompt couples with no fertility problems to seek IVF just to have the opportunity. Okay. It's might sound unlikely, but reproductive technologies designed to avoid medical conditions are already being used to find out more about our future children. A different kind of test used to detect Down syndromes during pregnancy is being used by private clinics to discern the sex of babies very early in a pregnancy. Okay, I'm a bit confused. Concerns have been raised that this practice gives people more chance to opt for abortions based on gender, although we don't know to what extent the test is being used in this way, if at all. Okay. All this means that politicians, regulators and public need to begin debating the far-reaching implication of polygenic IVF screening. For so long, the mantra has been that DNA tests for individuals can't tell us anything about the complex traits we haven't yet decided what we should do when they can. There is much for this debate to consider. Is it ethical to screen for disease risk but not predicted personality? But what about mental health problems or predisposition for autism? Okay, thank you very much. Should prospective parents be allowed to decide themselves, or should societies as a whole determine what's most ethical? It's a difficult conversation to have, but whether we like it or not, these technologies aren't far from being reality. Yeah, it is interesting that you've got these diseases which have zero reproductive success, however, they're not evolved out, you know. So, it would be interesting to see what the fertility rate of autistic people is overall. Okay, well, this is it. Page 6. We're going on to it by Claire Wilson. Choose your child's intelligence. We can now predict low IQ long before birth, reports Claire Wilson. The prospect of creating intelligent designer babies has been subject to ethical debate for decades, but we have lacked the ability to actually do it. And that may now change thanks to the new method of testing the embryo's genes that could have been soon be available in some IVF clinics in the US, the New Scientist can reveal. The firm Genomic Prediction says it's a little genetic screening test that can assess complex threats such as risk of some diseases and low intelligence in IVF embryos. The tests haven't yet been used yet, but the firm began talks last month with several IVF clinics to provide them to customers. For intelligence, Genomic Prediction says it will only offer the options of screening out of embryos deemed likely to have mental disability. Oh, gosh, that just makes me vomit. However, the same approach could in the future could use to identify embryos with genes that make them more likely to have a high IQ. Quote, I think people are going to demand that. If we don't do it, some other company will. Says the firm's co-founder, Stephen Hsu. For many years, it has been possible to do simple genetic tests on embryos as part of IVF. For example, parents at risk of having a child with cystic fibrosis have the option to undergo IVF to select the embryo that doesn't carry the gene behind the condition. This is also possible to screen for several other conditions caused by single gene, as well as those caused by chromosomal abnormalities such as Down syndromes. However, most medical conditions are influenced by hundreds of genes, such as made possible to screen out embryos at high risk of heart disease, for example, or select embryos with a low likelihood of experiencing depression. This is true for traits like intelligence too. In recent years, it has become possible to work out a person's likelihood of having certain conditions or traits by analysing many DNA regions at once to calculate something like called the polygenetic risk. See predicting embryos' future traits below. There is, I'll read that after you. Predicting potential. Genomic Prediction is the first company to offer polygenetic risk scores for embryos rather than adults. The firm is mainly promoting its tests as a way of screening out embryos at high risk of certain medical conditions. But the company's polygenetic test for mental disability is more controversial. It isn't accurate enough to predict the IQ for each embryo, but it can indicate which ones are genetic outliers, giving prospective parents the options of avoiding embryos with a high chance of an IQ 25 points below average, says Hassim. If we consider inclusion of diversity to be a measure of social progress, then IQ screening proposals are unethical, says Lynn Murray of Don't Screen Us Out, a group of campaigns against prenatal testing of Down syndromes. There must be a wide consultation. The information from the same test could be used to go one step further and select whichever embryo is likely to have the high IQ. What that corresponds to is way above average intellectual potential, says Susie. For ethical reasons, Genomic Prediction won't help parents select for high IQ to in this. Wow. Yeah, it just means that they're going to have a premium product, which you charge millions of dollars for. Predicting an embryo's future traits. Genetic testing for complex traits used to be impossible. That's because they're affected by hundreds of different genes, each with just a small influence, only a small fraction of which have been identified. But thanks to studies involving hundreds of thousands of people, more DNA regions implicated in this kind of traits have been found. A study published in July found more than 1,000 DNA regions that together accounted for 13% variation in academic achievement. Wow. And their influence can be higher for certain people. For example, a rare gene variant may only account for a tiny percentage of the variation of intelligence across the population, but it may make a big difference to the IQ of those who have it. As it becomes possible to estimate the future intelligence of an embryo, it's in the main story, some prospective parents will discover that some of the IVF embryos have a high chance of intellectual disability. Oops. While others may find that one of the embryos is likely to have a especially clever. There are no certainties, but for a few, this could be a big difference. And the July study found that 60% of those with genetic score in the top fifth of the group got a university degree, compared with 10% in those at the bottom fifth. Oh, sorry. I've done this. I haven't realised this is the original article again. Nevertheless, it seems likely. So this is a buy thing. I was going to read it second, but this article goes on. I didn't see it. Okay, nevertheless, it seems likely that other forms will do so in the future. If it doesn't happen in the US, it will happen in another country, says Kelvin Mitchell of Trinity College in Dublin, Ireland. The idea of using such tests as the embryos predicted to have high intelligence is repugnant, but technologically feasible, says geneticist Peter Fisher of the University of Queensland, Australia. Intelligence is only one trait the firm can give a polygenic risk for, score for. Others often include heart disease, breast cancer, type 1, 2, diabetes, and inflammatory bowel disease. Oh my god. All the geneticists new scientists spoke to agree that the principles behind polygenic testing are valid, but Mitchell says the service may be of limited use to in practice because many people using IVF have just a few embryos to choose from. What's more, if the embryos all share the same biological parents, they are unlikely to show much variation of the polygenic scores of various traits. Also, we don't yet fully understand what other effects the many genes involved in the traits like higher intelligence and lower risk of heart disease might have. For example, some studies suggest that people with higher polygenetic scores for academic ability are more likely to be autistic. You don't know what you're selecting for and what comes with it, says Fisher. But there are people who pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to have their dead pet cloned. I'm sure there are people who would do this. In the UK, screening embryos for polygenic conditions isn't currently allowed. So the UK, they can only be screened for similar genetic conditions. But if IVF doctors want to change, I take my hat off to what they're doing. It's a potential revolution, says Simon Fischel, the president of the Care Fertility Groups in the UK. Oh my god. US votes on science. I think they voted on a fair number of things, but let's see what they have to say. I don't know who wrote this article. Alongside the US midterm congressional elections last week, voters were asked to decide various science-related measures. The results were a mixed bag. So, you're coming up to polls, give us a vote. I don't know, this is just insane. Voters in Washington State rejected a proposed carbon tax, good on you, which would have charged oil firms and other large polluters $15 per tonne for emitted carbon. Had it passed, this would have been the first fee imposed on greenhouse gas emissions in the US. In Arizona and Nevada, renewable energy was on the ballot in the form of measures designed to require electricity firms to get half their power from renewables. Nevada passed the measure by a large margin. Arizona rejected it. I suppose, I'm just trying to work out. It on one hand, it proves that the voting system has to be stupid, because on the other hand, it is giving you a diversity of policies. The Colorado initiative to limit fracking by banning the drilling of oil and gas wells within 762 metres, it must be some sort of imperial measurement, half a mile, occupied buildings or protected land failed at the polls. But voters in Florida felt differently, at least where oceans were concerned, approving a measured ban of offshore drilling. In California, voters rejected a proposal to spend $9 billion to repair dams to build water infrastructure. I think California wanted to do that. Isn't they completely drought? Oh, yeah. Okay. The drought-prone state is currently enduring the deadliest wildfire in history. According to U.S. officials, over 40 people have died in the campfire, and 7,000 structures have been destroyed. So it's just an unusual name for a fire. It's called the campfire. It's, if you read many years, I suppose that's the name of their fires. Well, why do they have to say This is a bit odd. According to US officials, just odd. Abortion rights were also put on the vote in some states. In Oregon, a measure was rejected that would have curbed state funds being used to pay for abortion service and would have prevented public employees from receiving an abortion using their state-provided insurance. In Alabama, voters approved a policy to recognize the rights of unborn children, giving fetuses the same legal rights as a person. Democrats won on the House of Representatives, meaning they will head for the House Committee on Science, Space and Technology for the first time. The outgoing chair, Republican Lamar Smith of Texas, is known for his skepticism of climate change and his hostility to scientists. What? What? The House Committee on Science, you're skeptical. Oh, God. Johnson said she will pursue an agenda, quote, to address the change of climate, the challenge of climate change, starting with acknowledging it's real, seeing to understand that climate science is telling us, and working to understand the ways we can mitigate it, unquote. Oh, dear. United States. Flexi screen phones set for mainstream. What we all really need. Samsung has become the first major manufacturer to unveil a smartphone with a folding screen. That almost hurts to think about. How does that work? The device with an Infinity Flex display was revealed at the firm's annual developer conference last week. The screen will be built into its popular line of Galaxy phones. Folding screens give you two devices at once. There must be a hinge involved. It mustn't be a continuous hinge. You can use Samsung's 18.5cm bendy touchscreen to watch videos, play games, and write reports. When you're done, just fold the half and turn the tablet-sized device into fits in your pocket. So it must be... the details of the device are scarce. It's not expected to hit the market until 2019. Anyone thinking of upgrading should be aware that the phone costs £1,375. However, we may soon have a peak of the crop next year. It has been billed as the year of the folding phone, with versions expected in Apple, LG, Motorola, and Huawei. Wow, that's just going to do my head in. Oil demand will keep growing. Go oil. We need to slash greenhouse emissions to limit global warming, but the International Energy Agency sees a very different future in a new report looking at the next 20 years. Okay, hurts my head to read that. The World's Energy Outlook 2018 predicts the growing energy demand in developing countries will cause global carbon dioxide emissions to keep rising. The biggest growth will be in India, where energy demand will double. Demand in China will grow more slowly, but will still become the world's biggest energy consumer of oil. The IEA expects continued growth in global demand for oil to lead to shortages in 2020 unless more oil projects get the go-ahead. Critics say the IEA reports have consistently... underestimate the growth of renewables. The agency says its reports are designed to show where policies will take us so governments can make better choices. News and technology section. This article is by Leah Crane. Space explosion is too bright, too fast. A space explosion, nicknamed the Cow, keeps on getting stronger. Now, I was just trying to think, there was another thing, which is, I think, the campfire and the cow thing. I don't know why it's called Cow. Okay, so this is an explosion, and everyone says talk about the cow. After months of observation, now I wonder cow. I don't think it would necessarily be. It's normally just random letters that you identify explosions by. So let's see why it's called the cow. After months of observation, we still aren't quite sure what it is, but it may be part of a whole new class of blasts. In June, the astronomers, so this is in space, they have the one I'm going to add now is more technology. So astronomers at night point their telescopes at space, and they're all linked by the World Wide Telescope, and report to each other. If they see anything, abnormal, computerized telescopes send out alarms and everyone points their telescopes to pick up things. Okay. In June, astronomers spotted a remarkably fast and luminous explosion. Luminous means it gives out a lot of light. It took just a few days to reach peak brightness, whereas most supernova, these are exploding stars. Supernova is a star which becomes unstable. The pressure, inward pressure wave starts off, the infalling pressure wave starts off a much higher grade of nuclear reaction, which causes a recoil which accelerates the incoming pressure wave. So you have a pressure wave traveling from the outer star to the inside of the star. I'm doing at the moment is deciding to just increase the level of explanations I give right across the board. So this is describing, so you have a star like our sun, it will start to pulsate, and the waves, on the crest of a wave there will be nuclear reaction which will cause the star to evaporate, and it'll cause the surface star to push inwards. And so a supernova has a great explosion and implosion, a lot of the star glows millions of times brighter. It's just incredibly bright, an explosion to come across. It takes several days for it to, the pressure wave to go in to reach peak brightness. Now, although the light comes out, it actually takes several days for the light to get through the mass coming out. So the explosion will be quite quick, but there's a certain amount of generalized mass which it goes through. Bear in mind the amount of time it takes for light to get from the center of our sun to the surface is over a million years. So it's big, but it's not that big. It's something to imagine. Now, of course, this is slightly different thing. Okay, which occur when a star blows up and dies, takes a few weeks or longer. It has 10 to 100 times brighter than the most normal supernova. So that is a bit of a problem. So supernova have to be a certain star anyway. The sort of minimum brightness of a supernova, it's a 1A supernova, is one minimum brightness supernova. So let's look around. So this is very bright. Telescopes around the world were turned to face the blast, dubbed the COW after it was officially listed as AT-2018 COW, simply because the cosmic events get a three-letter labels, its alphabetical order based on when they're seen. Okay, so let's go back. There's internet things, and telescopes, if they're not been tasked, will automatically sync to where they're told. You can get telescopes now, which are voice activated. You can just pop them down and say, show me Alpha Centauri, and we'll work out where it is, and Alpha Centauri will come up in the viewfinder. It sort of is a bit weird to do it, and essentially you can task telescopes to look wherever you want, if you haven't got an astronomer in the way. Now, there's comets are named this way, and COW just happens to be the numbers for it. Now, I wonder what AT stands for, Astronomic Telescope, or I don't know what AT, 2018 COW. The initial observations couldn't explain it, so lots of astronomers continue to watch. Using 12 telescopes, Rafael Magrita of the Northern University in Illinois and her team examined the explosions and several wavelengths of light. None of the observations resembled a regular supernova, she says. They found high energy X-rays from the COW, which should die down as the blast goes on. They were increasing. This was a huge surprise. So, they redid the analysis, but the results were the same. Visible light coming from the COW added to the mystery too. It's very blue, which means it's hot. It's so blue, which means something is keeping it hot. It's not expanding. It's one aspect. You know, what is it? It may be sort of a two-tap supernova. It could be interesting. Yes, I don't know. That's okay. So that's my thought. If things cool down, there is radiation to space, but the major things, way something cools down quickly, and days or whatever it is not the radiation escaping, but the actual thermodynamic expansion. So if you've got an object, it will stay hot for a fair while. So, for instance, something which is very dense, like a white dwarf, which is the core of a star, which is a degenerate matter. It's very dense. It's got high density. It will stay hot for world and through to the end of the universe. You know, white dwarfs only very, very gradually cool down, and they have degenerate matter, the energy inside. So things have to generally expand. That's how they cool down. They also detected irregular X-ray frequencies, which suggests the cow is asymmetrical, and it may have a ring or dust or cloud around it, which is what I would say it has to have something holding it in. Another group led by Anna Holo, it must be the Death Star. I think it would be alien life. Anna Ho of California Institute of Technology came to a similar conclusions. It's interesting that you've got women doing this. They found that the radio waves emitted by the cow suggested the explosion is spreading through a dense medium. Okay, well this is my entire thing. Yeah. Like clouds of gas that some stars belch out before becoming supernova. It has some of the features common with many types of things, but it doesn't fit neatly into any one category, says Ho. It's a really totally strange. Together, the two sets of observation paint a picture of a very powerful explosion blasting through clouds that lent extra oomph to the central energy source, or engine. The whole thing is ringed with debris. Well, yeah, so that's not knowing what it is. I just think, yeah, it may be actually a failed supernova. The problem is a lot of central energy sources look alike, said Metzger. The cow sits in the not-too-distant dwarf galaxy. We have seen other explosions that look similar, but they have always been so far away that we haven't been able to study them in any detail. Observations of the cow may mark the first time we are witnessing the finer features of a new type of space explosion. Quote, we're entering the era now where the zoo of astronomical events has just gotten out of hand, says Messier. This rare opportunity to examine the beastery up close. And so I love that idea. And it's really interesting, the dwarf animals. Now, Blob's first animal claim could go pop. I wonder what... I don't think they're saying this is a plant, but okay, let's see. A weird sea creature half a billion years ago may not be Earth's first animal after all. So 500 million years ago, there were no life. By 360, life was crawling out of the sea. So in that time, dark time between 500 and 360, that, brief 140 million years, we went from nothing, blobs, through all these sea creatures to something coming out. It's sort of like a flash of an eye to come out. Now, we have to rethink where the Dickinsonia, now I've forgotten what that's why it's called that way, pictured above, so it's a fairly amazing picture, sits in the tree of life after evidence emerged on an unusual feeding strategy, inflating its body like a balloon. Because it isn't seen in any animal today, it raises questions whether it belongs in the animal kingdom, having been put in it after fossil analysis suggested an animal-like molecular fingerprint. Okay, so indeed you could have I suppose you could have inflating sludges or whatever it is, plants, like your fungi and stuff like that. Okay, So it's like, I think it's been described as some sort of doormat. One would love to know what the scale of that is up there. If a Dicksonia was an animal, it may have been a very odd one, says Nicole Law of Scott, and Scott McKenzie of Mercer University, Pennsylvania, who made the finding. It's one of the Echadrians, a group of life forms that lived tens of millions of years before familiar early animals like sponges. So tens of millions of years, so we've got the sponges, which are an animal. They sit there and they've got a symbiotic process with them, you know, with the algae and stuff like that. Now, the sponge is an animal. That's pretty amazing thing to get. It's just tens of millions of years. Sounds a long time, but that's actually not a very long time. That's half a billion years, 510 billion years before. Its fossils looks around, flat rib blobs up to a meter long, but just a few millimeters thick. So it is basically a doormat. It looks like a doormat, a very thin doormat. Law and McKenzie studied the unusual radial lines of rock fringing one of the Dicksonian fossils. They say these suggest the organism shrank when dead, leaving scratches in the sand below as it shriveled up. Okay, so it's even bigger, but the fossilized thing means it's going down. Okay. About 21% of the total fossil area is taken up by this fringe. So, this is outside the fringe. This comes in. She says that a live Dicksonia was longer, wider, and taller than its fossil suggests, which is like most fossils, aren't they? The body was inflated, and most fossils show it is a smaller and thinner deflated state. Although the study hinges on one fossil, Law and Rex Powell at the University of California, Berkeley have been working on the idea for about 10 years. Powell joined Law and McKenzie to present the inflatable Dicksonia idea at the meeting of the Geological Society of America in Indianapolis last week. Inflating could have been a feeding strategy. Dicksonia have been viewed as a seabed grazer. Well, what is it else going to be? It's going to be a predator. You know, there's not other animals for it to eat. I don't know. What's it gonna... Okay. I suppose it's rather than looking at the actual material floating through. Inflating could have allowed it to cover more seabed. The pufferfish can inflate its stomach to deter predators. Okay, that just seemed really relevant to me. But Dicksonia seems to have inflated its entire body. As such, Law suggests that it might fall not into the animal branch of the tree, but on an underpinned nearby branch. Perhaps it was an animal, she says, but we don't believe we have enough evidence to know for sure right now. Well, I think they picked up, there's apparently keratin and lipids, fats, which are unique to animals. So, I mean, that's all you have to say, that it may not have been an animal, it may have been a plant producing these lipids. That's all, I think that's all they're trying to say. Civilization Shaped Human Evolution by Michael Marshall. Are humans still evolving? Well, I'm not. That's me saying that. So evolution is this process where over genes, your genes have natural variation in your gene pool, but your population of different types of genes, I suppose, essentially shrinks. Certain genes are removed from the gene pool, and certain genes are more successful at being reproduced. It's a thing. Because evolution usually takes many generations, it's hard to tell. But two genetic studies reveal DNA changes that took hold within the last few thousand years, suggesting that modern lifestyles have recently shaped our evolution and are probably still doing so. Okay, so DNA is a deoxynucleic acid. So the sugar, the RNA, is you remove an oxygen from it, and so that's why it's deoxyribose, and it's removing the oxygen. So if you look at the ribose, which is a typical six carbon hydrocarbonate with an esterization. This is an oxygen linking, I think, 1 and 4 together. And so typically in most sugars, every carbon has a OH and an H linked to it. But in this case, an OH has been removed, and so it's deoxy, the short one. And so the DNA is the code for your genetic information. So the way that your DNA is structured. So the DNA is a periodic crystal made out of bases, and the bases it's the information stored in it. Quote, during a short time, human genomes have changed a lot. So a genome is basically the available information in your genes. Think that might be. I really wonder what the word genome means. I really wonder what the word genome means, whether that's a species wide or thing. It says, Irina Morozova of the University of Zurich insists on, quote, we think these changes have driven by human civilization. Okay. Well, this is rather interesting. Or did the changes create civilization? This is a big question. Both studies looked for evidence of evolution favouring some DNA sequences over others, a process called selection. So that's what... So you've got your evolution. You've got evolution. This is your variation and your selection. Mozovora and her colleagues compared some genomes of 150 Europeans with... So genomes is your complete genetic... It doesn't necessarily say which is expressed or not. From between 5,500 and 3,000 years ago. So the Europeans are in there, and so this is pre-civilization. However, going back then, people still lived in villages. Modern Europeans descended from them. Now, we know that around this time there was a bit displacement, people coming in. This allowed the team to identify various processes of evolution that acted on Europeans in the past 6,000 years. In the past 5,500 years, I would say. The team found changes over time in the way that the body metabolizes carbohydrates. That is, eats crops, I suppose. Mozovora suggests that these happened when societies began farming. Okay. Probably switched from meat-heavy, hunter-gathered diet to a starchier, more sugary one. She thinks human metabolism is still evolving and doing so for millennia. Eating of sugars is mitochondrial DNA, so this makes me a bit confused. It's not like we're completely adapted to this. I really wonder how she's actually they've nailed that, because it's a bit flaky. There was evidence that evolutionary changes in several aspects of the immune system, too. It's not clear what these changes do, but they have been response to exposure of new diseases some 6,000 years ago, when people began living in more crowded conditions and spending more time with livestock. I don't know. I find that's all hard to do. You'd have to know how does the immune system change anyway. It's really a bit flaky for me. So if you have the immune system changing, say, every 1,000 years, the factor of 1, every 1,000 years the immune system's changing, and then you suddenly see it pick up, yes, maybe so. But the other thing is, what happens to a large population versus a small population? So if you've got a large population, it's sort of sampling more areas and bring them in, is my overall thing. So if you've got just a single evolutionary, if you've got a small population, I just really wonder how. So we've got 1,000 versus 1,000,000 genetic experiments coming on, and if you are relying on unlikely freaks coming in, having a large population allows that to come in, whereas if you've got a small population, it allows for mutations to explore mutations more. You know, you will accept a mutation because it's a small population, it's the best that could happen. I know what I'm thinking about because I've used evolutionary algorithms, so it's really interesting about the size of the population and the error that you associate with it. But the two processes stood out, showing very few evolutionary changes over the same period. Okay, these are things which don't do it. These are how eggs form, and the long-term potentiation, a process of the brain that aids learning by strengthening the connections commonly used in neural pathways. Gee whiz, you know what, I think you would need, it's not the change you're looking at, rate of change, this has never changed. It looks as if both have been protected from changing, says Moritz Voser. The second study, Fernando Rampsko of the University of Copenhagen, Denmark, and his colleagues developed a new way to detect selection in modern human genomes, even when their ancestral populations have split and merged throughout history. They discovered the SLC45A2, a gene variant involved in skin and eye colour, became more common in early Europeans. This suggests it played a role in evolution of paler skin, which is thought to have arisen in the past 10,000 years. They also identified many genes that seem to have been evolving relatively recently in East Asian groups, whose gene history has not been well studied as the ancestral Europeans. Cells are involved in the immune system. Quote, they have to do with how the body learns to respond to new threats, says Amerika. Evolution during the last few hundred years is hard to spot because the signals are weaker. But Amerika says humans are definitely still evolving. Quote, the question is, what are the selective pressures that determine evolution? What are the probability of very different from the selective pressures between 5,000 and 100,000 years ago? Yeah, I think it's sort of the thesis here is a bit confused. It's just, I don't know what it is. It's a little bit confusing. Another article by Michael Marshall. This is the second article. Extinct monkey evolved to live like a sloth. So a sloth are these animals which have got a low-calorie food diet, therefore have developed a large stomach, a large processing process, and also to move very, very slowly. These sloths move very, very slowly to conserve energy. So they will move, and they tend to have large claws for some reason. And so they move very, very slowly in a tree canopy in Guatemala and South America. This is a sloth thing. So a monkey, which you normally think about skipping around the place, has, rather than hopping around the place, you know, these tamarins which jump around, this one's here. And you can imagine a sloth in the zoo not getting much. Now, the sloth in Ice Age is very anachronistic, that it moves, it talks and stuff like that. But it still has a very low forehead face. Okay, about 11 million years ago, monkeys somehow crossed the sea from South America to the island of Jamaica in the Caribbean. Well, I'd like to know how they did. There, they evolved into a new species that was unlike any other known monkey. It's a striking example of how living on an island can transform a species and preserve DNA has set a glimpse of the details. So, there's a lot of things. The humans separated in Indonesia, the island of Flores, have shrunk. The in Malta, which is an island, as sea levels rose in the Mediterranean, but the area of Malta shrunk and shrunk and shrunk, and the animals and elephants went higher and higher up, had a smaller and smaller island in that area, and as they were isolated, they became smaller. However, there are some other cases where, as in King Island, which is an island in Bass Strait of Australia, the snakes there have no natural predators, so the tiger snakes, these are deadly snakes, So they've been isolated there. Similar Bass Strait, the Aboriginals walked from Victoria to Tasmania. The sea levels went down. So Bass Strait's got powerful currents because it's fairly shallow, Bass Strait. It's got this island sticking out in Bass Strait. And so as the sea level rose, isolated these populations of animals. And the animals grew much, much bigger. So often island populations can be quite, quite different. Okay. The first remains of the Xenothrix means foreign thrix. McGregory, so it's by someone like McGregory, was discovered in 1920, Jamaican's Long Mile Cave. Okay. The few bones found reveal a highly unusual monkey with relatively few teeth and leg bones similar to those of a rodent. All the leg bones are similar to a rodent, so I wonder what that means. What they suggest is a very slow-moving, perhaps even soft-like lifestyle, says Ross McFay. My problem here is that she's just said, I've looked at the DNA, and here are non-DNA things. The X. McGregory was related to South American monkeys, but it also had so you see how it's related to other monkeys. But it also had unusual that biologists were unclear which group it belonged to. To clear up the mystery, McPhee and his colleagues extracted the DNA from two X. McGregory bones. They managed to recover a full mitochondrial genome, so you've got your main DNA, which is the iconic stuff, but also from your mum, you've got the cell, your bacterial, so you enslave bacteria which eat sugar and emit something called ATP, adenine triphosphate. And this is a chemical which gets powered up and gives all the power to your proteins within your cell, so your proteins get activated and move when this triphosphate ATP is juiced through it. And that's done by the mitochondria. Now, all cells have at least one mitochondria, but heart cells, cells which we use all the time, they never get tired, always use all energy, have thousands of mitochondria in them. And these are these little cells which eat up sugar and produce energy. Now, they're being held, these cells are put down the egg line, so it's only maternal mitochondria DNA only comes from the mother, and if you have a mitochondrial disease, you have an energy problem. Okay, which animals only inherit from their mother? Well, there you go. So it's only in the eggs, and seven chunks of nuclear genome. So nuclear is the genome is the actual the DNA. Which is a long strip of stuff. The team compared the samples with the equivalent sequences of 15 South American primate groups and found that X. McGregory belonged to a group called the Titis. These monkeys live in forests and eat fruit and lack prehensile tails. Okay, this is the new standard monkey tails. Well, which is rather interesting because I thought apes were the only, great apes were the only one. X. McGregory doesn't look like a typical titi monkey, though. Also arriving on the island evidently forced its ancestors to evolve. The selective pressures on them must have been just extreme, so it looks like it got thrown in a mixer. The reason is unknown. X. McGregory died up about 900 years ago. What we think, but we can't demonstrate, is X. Chronis was a victim of either direct or indirect impacts of the first humans who got there, says McPhee. Well, that's a bit of a throw. My only other thing is that if you actually write out arguments, like as you read these arguments, I've got this imaginary whiteboard in my head, and I say, oh, it could go this way. It could be that the monkeys were trapped on this island for a long time and they went to South America and evolved the other way. I don't know necessarily what. I mean, it's unlikely, but I mean, it could be that yeah, that has to be considered. Okay, oh god. 49 minutes, I've got 10 minutes to read these two articles here. So here's a picture of Roman inspiration for ancient script. Now, I think this is into the Picts. So I don't know whether... so the Picts use, very famously, a picture language. And so here's a Pictish symbol stone, such as Coglash, is difficult. Dating of the stone is difficult. Well, perhaps give it up to the Australian nuclear reactor. We'll tell you pretty soon how old things are. But this stone... I think, I don't know whether the Romans, the Latin for picture is picture, or the Picts were Picts, and we call pictures for the Picts. So I like that, the Picts. See if they've picked up on that. But the diagrams are quite interesting. The Picts are a Digimon-backed coalition of tribal kingdoms that inhabited the far north of what's now known as Scotland for about 1,700 to 1,100 years ago, might have been inspired by the Romans to develop a writing system of their own. Well, I think the Picts were... The Romans actually fought the Picts, so... Oh, yeah, 1,100... 1,100... Yeah, so I do remember... The Picts were being driven out by the Romans, and they were on an isthmus and were about to be wiped out, and the Romans suddenly got a call from Rome, and the Roman army just suddenly wasn't there anymore. They were down there to fight something off in the Black Sea. They were all pulled off the Black Sea, so which is rather interesting that in ancient times, you just round there and bash up the other tribe and exterminate. The Romans, because they were so efficient, didn't actually kill off these groups completely. They absorbed them, they kept them alive, and so the Picts were allowed to survive. So when would that 1,007? See, 1,700 years is not old enough. That's 300 AD. I think it's older than that, if I can remember. You've got Hadrian's Wall, because the Romans, you know, it's before Hadrian when they tried to fight the Picts. We know that the Picts from the Roman Empire's written records. It was the Roman writer Eumerus who coined the name Picti, literally painted people, in 297, probably referring to their tattoos. Ah, okay. Okay, so that makes sense. 297 AD is about the right time, but I think they've been there for many hundred years before that. As far as we know, the Picts themselves left no surviving written records. One thing they did leave, though, is a collection of about 200 stone slabs adorned with the symbols of varying complexity. They are carved of bulls, eagles, fish, as well as geometric patterns. Among the symbols are around 300 that appear often, almost always in pairs, because the slabs were found in locations that seem to have been important to the Picts. These paired symbols are thought to be some sort of naming system for Pictish families, although there's no agreement on their precise meanings. Well, that's... Yeah, you get a very biased, the stone here, well, this area must have been important. But there may have been another area equally important they didn't leave a stone to, but we wouldn't pick up. The logic there really escapes me. So there's a stone, and they just sort of edge it out. I'm just really, really, really trying to think what's happening here, and how they go out. So this is Scottish. Now the Picts, I don't think were red-headed. I think the Scotties from the Black Sea came up to Scotland. The Scotty people came to Scotland. So I think they're different race. Gordon Noble of the University of Aberdeen in UK and his colleagues have found a way around this problem. Okay, so dating the carvings could help solve the mystery, but it's hard because the stone carvings leave no convenient organic marker for carbon dating. I think it's actually getting this right on carbon dating things, but Okay, let's see what they're doing. Gordon Noble of the University of Aberdeen, so they can't do carbon dating. They dated organic material from ancient fort called Dunica, which lies in Scotland's northeast and may have been the centre of Pictish power. The rubble from the four ruined walls contains a few symbol carved stones. The results suggest the walls were built in the 3rd or 4th century, which is a few hundred years earlier than the symbols was previously thought to be in use. This surprised Noble and his team. They argued it might suggest that the symbol system arose from contact with the Roman Empire, as the Romans still had a presence in Britain when the wall at Doncaster was built. Where did the Picts learn to write scripts? This the obvious connection between the Roman Empire, says Noble. Roman coins and pottery have been found in caves in northern Scotland, possibly gathered during the Pictish raids. Noble's idea is that seeing Latin scripts let the Picts develop their own writing system. Gee, that's so woolly. There is precedence of this elsewhere in Northern Europe. Yeah, well, this is really interesting because they've only got symbols after contact with Roma, so I'd pay you that one. For instance, encounters with the Roman Empire are thought to have inspired the Ogham script used in Ireland and the runic system used in Scandinavia. Karen Millick of Durham University thinks the argument is compelling. Dating evidence and contextual analysis of Pictish symbols significantly enhance our understanding of Pictish symbols, their origins, uses, and meanings. Yeah, I have to agree with that, because there's no symbols before Roman contact in all these cases. Quantum radar... Quantum radar can spot even stealth planes. My concern is that stealth planes do not radiate the radar pulse back. So you can detect a stealth plane by actually placing an emitter and detector in a line and seeing it cross, but you can't. It doesn't put light back. Quantum one is you have to get the symbol back. Oh, this is a bit confusing to me. A company claims to have created a quantum radar. This is by David Hambling. A company claims to have created a quantum radar that detects stealth aircraft and see through the radar jamming used by hard war planes. Oh, gee, that's a bit... Defense giant China Electronics Technology Group Corporation displayed the new prototype at Zhuhai Air Show last week. Stealth aircraft avoid detection by redirecting most of the radar system's radio waves, which usually reflect off the surface and reveal their location. In theory, a quantum radar can overcome this by using two streams of entangled photons. These pairs of photons that have a weird connection, so a change in one affects the other, even if they're miles apart. The first photon stream is sent out like a standard radar beam and bounces the object in the sky. The second one remains inside the system. Because the photons are entangled, the returning photons can be matched to those in the stay-at-home stream. So the background noise can be filtered out, such as radar jamming and spoof signals put to confuse the radar. That's possible. What is left is a clear image of the target with no extraneous signal. Without being able to take the lid off what has been shown here, we can't be sure if it's an elaborate hoax, says Woodland at the University of Surrey, UK. I think that's my thing. It's just got hoax written all over it. But China has fallen with quantum technology, having surprised the world with the speed at which it developed the first quantum satellite communication. If quantum radar is real, it would be the first of its kind. The new technology would significantly reduce the ability of stealth aircraft, such as bombers, to remain undetected. This is Justin Bronk, the UK defence think tank, Royal United Services Institute. Although it's not necessarily grounding operations, it could make them more dangerous. Gee, that's just... That's... I think you should just add AI, baby, children, cats, whales, and, I don't know, ancient civilizations. He added that to the article. You tick every box whatsoever. Thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.